Paul says it's simple, eliminate two strokes. And then Jason says they're coming for all gas-powered engines. California has already banned two-cycle chainsaws, weed eaters, and leaf blowers. By 3035 or 2035, all vehicles have to be zero emission. The EPA uses California emissions as their standard. Then John comes and says they have banned them in some lakes around me. I have an old Johnson 122 stroke on my 18-foot glass ply. Another John also comes in and says the sooner all two strokes are banned, the better. And then we've also got Brian, and he says they banned all two stroke jet skis years back on the Colorado River system. So we were going to talk about this topic. I've got tons and tons of other comments about the two stroke thing. Should they be banned? Should they not be banned? There's a big discussion here, so we are going to talk about it. I want to thank everybody for commenting and subscribing. This is a wonderful topic. It seems that there are a lot of people that are very, very passionate about this. I mean, it's almost like there is a two-stroke mafia out there, and you do not want to cross the mafia. So we're going to kind of talk about the pros and the cons of the two-stroke, and are they really going to ban them, and should they be banned? We have another one. Crisp over here says, hi, mate, here in Australia, they actually banned the sale of two-strokes about 6 to 7 years ago. You can still buy a secondhand one, but the dealers are not allowed to sell them only four-strokes. Yet in Southeast Asia, you can still buy them. I have always had a two-stroke engine before buying a new four-stroke that cost me $9,200 Australian for a 40 horsepower and always trusted them. I think it is just making money out of the West, which is very possible. We had another user that then says, what's the reason two-stroke outboards are being banned? And a lot of it has to do with EPA and regulations. Honestly, that's pretty much it. It's all about regulations. You know, I get both sides of the coins. I think that I love two-strokes on one hand, and on the other hand, I hate them. So, you know, as far as it comes to working on them, from a mechanic standpoint and from a shop standpoint, most shops don't work on them anymore, especially in Florida. If you get down here in Florida, in Southeast Florida, South Florida, in the Keys, anywhere down here in the super, super salt water, hot water all the time, two strokes just do not come out well. I mean, everything breaks on them. Like the 90 we're working on now, I broke four bolts on that thing. A simple job that should have taken 2 hours then took 3 days. So 4 days, actually. So I get it from a mechanical standpoint and from a shop owner standpoint, where if someone brings in a two stroke and they, you know, are only going to want to pay for 2 hours, 3 hours that should take a job, but when stuff breaks, then it takes 16 hours. So the person's not going to want to pay for that. And I think that there's probably a big disconnect on if you own a two-stroke and you can work on it all day, you know, that's fine. There's not a problem there because it's your time. You're the one that has to deal with it. You don't have to pay someone to deal with it. But a lot of shops, they see them as losers. And every time they work on one, they lose money on it because they lose time. And there's so much other stuff out there to work on that they just don't want to work on them anymore. There's many places down here that will not work on them. So me personally, I don't like taking on two strokes as far as anything outside of my own personal projects and content creation. So, you know, that's kind of my standpoint from a mechanical aspect of it. But on the other side of it, the simplicity of a two stroke and the lightweight I think I have another comment up here for the weight issue, which we'll talk about. But the issues that go into, you know, the cost of maintenance to maintain a two-stroke versus a four-stroke, it's a lot cheaper to maintain, even though you do have to buy oil and stuff like that in order to run it. And then on the other side, from the regulation standpoint and the pollution standpoint, I understand it on like smaller lakes, certain rivers, springs, like stuff like that. You know, two-strokes pollute. There's not really anybody out there that is going to say that two strokes don't pollute. You know, you can go into the emissions discussion and like, you know, oh, E-Techs and G2s, these engines are very emission efficient more than a four stroke. But at the same time, the byproduct of combustion when you're burning oil is still there. So they still pollute more even though they have better emissions. I mean, if you take your two-stroke engine, put it in a barrel, run the thing for 10 minutes in a barrel of water, and then take a look at that water, and you tell me that it's not polluting. So they do pollute. I mean, there is that. on the grand scale of everything, is getting rid of and banning two-strokes going to make a dent in the pollution problem? Probably not. I mean, on a very, very, very micro level, it is. But at the same time, the whole pollution discussion is so far a big above that when you start looking at economics and macroeconomics. And I mean, everything that we buy, especially in the West, like what Crisp is saying about, you know, getting money off of the West, in order to get all the products that we use, the pollution that is made to ship all the products and the pollution that is made to make all the products that we consume over here with all the plastics and all the consumables and all the clothes and everything that comes from India and China and Vietnam and, like, I mean, everything that we buy, the pollution that is made in order to create those products and then ship those products over here is vastly outweighs the amount of pollution that Joe Blow with his 92 stroke out on, you know, the lake every other weekend for 4 months out of the year is going to be making. So I think there's a discussion on both sides. And are you really, you know, doing much there by cutting out the two-stroke? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I get it. You don't want on a small lake or pond to be running these two-strokes that are burning oil, like going back to the barrel. If you run the engine for 10 minutes in the barrel, look in that barrel. There's tons of oil and black and everything's dirty. So, like, you know, that's just going into the lake or the pond that you're running the engine in. So they do pollute. There is that side of the coin. You can't really argue that side. But at the same time, in order to ban them in America, you know, we're big on freedom. So, you know, you start talking about banning anything, it's you know, everybody, it's an infringement on our rights, basically. So there is that aspect of it when the banning comes from. But places like California and New York and places like that, like, that's your state. So that's the beauty of the United States. I mean, I don't ever see them banning two strokes in Florida or Texas or Alabama or Mississippi or, like, you know, any of these other places. I highly doubt you'll ever gonna see a ban of two strokes, because by the time the two stroke just simply goes away from the lack of production and no one has them, they just slowly are gonna die off. That's just what it's gonna happen over here. Over California, totally different story. And like what Brian was saying in Colorado, you know, that's different. So the Colorado River, whole different topic there. So certain places, I think you're going to see them banned. Other places, it'll never happen. You'll never see it. They're just going to burn out and fall away. But in order to switch over from a two-stroke to a four-stroke, there's a lot of things that it's a problem. So Galactica says a big problem with four strokes, aside from the cost, is the extra weight over a two stroke, which Brian comes in on top of that and says twin 250 Mercury OptiMax Pro X's twin four strokes would be too heavy on my transom and could cause my scuppers to go near or below the waterline, creating a risk of sinking the boat. So it's not just about disparaging two-stroke engines. These comments also disregard many boats that were designed before four strokes were mainstream. So the weight is a big problem. There's a lot of older boats out there. So if you ban a two-stroke and you've got a boat that can't support the weight of a four-stroke, then, you know, you're basically telling this guy he's got to buy a new boat. And I mean, you know, that's pretty ridiculous. You know, oh my goodness, you have to buy a whole new boat because you can't afford to put four strokes on your boat. I mean, if you ain't got the money to put the four strokes on there, then you ain't got the money to buy a new boat. And there's probably nothing wrong with the boat. So why would you take a boat and put it in a graveyard and just let it rot because you want to get rid of two strokes? So I think that there's kind of a disconnect there. But again, you're not going to see this in most places. There's not going to be a ban. There's only going to be a ban in places like California where it is politics. But the weight issue, I think, is a bigger one than you would think about. And it's probably something that a lot of people don't think about unless you are in the space and you have to do this. So a lot of sailboaters or small engine runners, like people that have, say, little small John boats or canoes or stuff like that, and they transport their boat and they have to carry the engine. So, like, let's say you live on a sailboat and you push your dinghy in the water and you got to put the engine on there in order to run around wherever you're going. The weight difference between a four stroke, like, take a 9.9 engine, the 9.9 two stroke is going to weigh 40-50 pounds less than the 9.9 four-stroke. So in order for someone to be able to pick up and carry and manhandle an engine that weighs, you know, 100-some pounds, opposed to like a 60, 70 pound, which for some people is already going to be like a struggle. You know, like it's going to be a struggle for some people to be able to pick the engine up and then move it around to stick it down on the back of their boat or put it in their car, whatever it may be. So I think there is that aspect too that a lot of people aren't thinking about, that the benefit of the less components inside the two-stroke and the functionality of a combustion engine and a two-stroke versus a four-stroke is the weight. And if you have to carry your engine and remove it, put it in your car, whatever it may be, and that's just the way you use your boat, like we're saying, John boats, canoes, stuff like that, and you are going onto rivers and stuff like that and you transport it, that's a big problem. So I think that's what Galactica is talking about, is having to actually pick up the engine and move it around. And now you're telling this person that they basically can't have an engine or run it because of the weight. So should they be banned? I'm never a fan of banning anything. You know, honestly, I think being an American and living in the U.S., I'm big on the Constitution. I think people should be free to do what they want, when they want, no matter what. And that is like you get the good with the bad on the same side. So, you know, in order for you to get to do what you want to do and for me to get to do what I want to do, that means it has to be a blanket statement. And so, you know, if you go start telling people what they can and can't do and banning things based on whatever it may be, usually politics, then once you lose your rights, you don't get them back. So once you give up a certain freedom, you ain't going to get it back. So if you start banning stuff, it's going to be a problem. So personally, I do not think that they should be banned. I think that you should just let them die out. That's just what it is. Or make them better. I think there's multiple different ways about stuff. I think with the science and the actual research and development, take hydraulic fluid, for example. So if you look at hydraulic fluid, it's basically a pollutant and it's a problem. But if you look at like PowerPole and SeaStar and some of these other systems, they use a biodegradable hydraulic fluid. So if there is a leak, the hydraulic fluid or the hydraulic oil basically is biodegradable. So it's fine if you have a leak and it all dumps out. There's no problem. It's not a pollutant. So couldn't you design an oil the same way with whatever properties that you need? I'm not an oil engineer or anything like that, but you would think that would be a possible thing. A lot of it has to do with money. So obviously companies want to sell more products. They want to sell more engines. They want to, for people to spend more money, for them to make more money. But I think that would be a way better solution than, you know, banning them or just letting them die out. Because again, going back to some of the problems of the old boats and the weight and that kind of thing, even if you just stop selling two strokes and you only sell four strokes and all the two strokes die out, there's that group of people that still have that problem to resolve. So, and I don't think it's a small group of people either. I think that there is a large number of boats out there that have two strokes that if you put a four stroke on it, it's going to have a weight problem. And then also the problem of, you know, trying to carry a 60 pound engine versus a 120 pound engine is like, that's a legitimate problem no matter who you are. Being in shape doesn't really mean that you have the back muscles to manhandle a 120 pound engine and throw it around. Depending on the size, obviously, you know, a 2.5 is going to weigh a lot less and that's not really a problem. But some of the bigger ones, you get into a 9.9 or a 15, those are going to get pretty heavy. So being able to take those on and off the engine, off the boat and transport them, you got that problem there. So is there a better way? Possibly. Is electric the answer? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, electric has its own issues. So if pollution's really the problem, then, you know, moving everything over to electric isn't really resolving the pollution problem, because the pollution that is made in getting the batteries and creating the electricity and doing everything, I mean, electricity doesn't just come, you know, it's not just there. You have to make electricity. So whether that be by wind turbines, by water, by hydrogen, by nuclear power plants, like, I mean, the way electricity is made, made creates pollution no matter what you do. So if you make everything electric, you need more electricity. So, you know, how much pollution are you going to create the electrician or the electricity to fulfill the infrastructure that you need to supply all the power for all this stuff? If you go fully electric on all these outboards and all this stuff, it's probably net-net. I mean, you're probably not gaining anything and you're not getting rid of any pollution. You're just creating more work and more pollution. So who knows what the answer is. Should they be banned? I don't think so. Will they be banned? In some places, yes. In other places, no. Like I said, I don't think in Florida or some of these other places you're ever going to see a ban on two-strokes, but California and some of the other states, it's possible. I get certain ponds and rivers, you know, maybe that could be. And then Brad says, I'm running a 2018 250 Mercury. They want $70 a gallon for DFI oil. That's how they're going to run two strokes off the water. Wow. $70 for DFI oil. That's getting pretty ridiculous. Yeah. If you're spending an extra $70, $75, $80, $100 a gallon of oil every time you go out, I still think that there's a way maybe to create an oil or an oil product that will lubricate the engine and disperse heat and keep everything running properly that maybe isn't as harsh as using fossil fuel oil. So maybe I'm wrong there, maybe not. Eagle says, to me, two-stroke is more complicated than four-strokes. Four-strokes are simple and are a simple four, simple method. I don't know about that, Eagle. I mean, a two-stroke is simpler than a four-stroke. Four-stroke's got more moving parts. It's got more stuff. You got camshafts. You got valves. You got all kinds of other stuff going on there, opposed to a two-stroke that just has two strokes. So, I mean, I get what you're trying to say. Like, is it easier to work on a two-stroke than a four-stroke? For a four-stroke, a lot of people will find them easier to work on because you don't have to get into all the timing issues and the electrical issues that you do with a two-stroke, being different ignition systems and the stators and the triggers and all this other stuff, where a lot of four-strokes are pretty sensor-dependent and you don't really need all that information as diagnosing the ignition system on a two-stroke versus on a four-stroke, where a four-stroke, you've basically got, you know, your computer and your coil and an engine harness. You don't have all these other products in order to, or wires and boxes and stuff like that. So I think I kind of get what you're trying to say there. Pimp says, if I bought an engine that does have some salt buildup in it from the previous owner not rinsing it, what can I do to clean everything? You're going to just probably run some salt away in there. We're actually now, I just got the base gasket in for the 92 stroke. So now I can put the power head back on the 90, and we're going to be doing a video on Ridlime. So I think that everybody's going to find that video super, super helpful. Ridlime was the product that everybody in the comments was talking about. I mean, when we made the one video about cleaning the inside of the engine, there was probably 100 or so comments of Ridlime. So we're going to put it to the test. I took the water plate cover off. I took the head cover off, or the water jacket head cover off. And I've got pictures and video of the inside of the engine, and we're going to hook it up to the Ridlime, and we're going to run that for 2, 4, 6. We're just going to run it and see how long it takes to get it clean. So you'll be able to see exactly what that process is and how to do it. So depending on your buildup, if it's not that much, then you can just do some salt away, run it in a cycle, it'll be all right. But if it is a lot, then we'll see when the Ridlime, as soon as I get done with that, because I've never done it, and I'm very, very interested to see how well that process goes and whether or not, you know, how much, because when you see what's inside that engine, I left a lot of stuff in there. Like, it has got massive clumps of salt and like buildup inside the engine. So will it break down all those big clumps? Because there's one passage on the head that is like basically being blocked by a big chunk of like salt and corrosion and stuff. And I'm sure that thing just floats around inside there, and there's going to be a water restriction because of all that junk in there. So is it going to break that clump down and get it out? I don't know. I'm going to be very, very impressed if it does. So I can't wait to see how that whole process turns out once I do it, and what the inside of the engine looks like after I get done doing it. So maybe next week sometime, or well, actually, it'll be, that video will be out by the time you see this. So By the time this podcast comes out, you will already have seen that video. So there you go. William says, love your content. Thank you, William. Thank you for doing all of this. Absolutely. Thank you for subscribing and commenting. Great stuff. Question, can you review these new ClearPath rigging tubes? I saw some crazy tube setups from some boat companies, especially the big engines. Is the fuel line suffering from those 90 degree angles? I don't think the newer steering lines are affected. Interesting to see the those. So as far as the ClearPath rigging and that kind of thing, I mean, basically all they've done is just taken 90 degree pieces of PVC and put two of them together to make a U and, you know, basically ran a rigging tube down. Is it affecting the fuel line? Well, let's start with the steering lines. Most of those engines that the ClearPath rigging stuff is on are all electric steering. So there are no hydraulic lines going into the boat. So I don't think you're going to have a problem there. Can you do that with a steering cylinder? No, I don't think you can. You can't turn a hydraulic line that much because the hydraulic line, you can only turn it so much because of how thick it is and the inside diameter. It needs to be a specific like size in order to hold the pressure of the hydraulic fluid. So I don't know if you can get one of those to turn that much without it like it's going to kink is what's going to happen. So you're only going to get so much bend before that hydraulic line just clip and it crimps over and creates a restriction. Everything else that's going inside the engine is just a main harness. And then you're going to have the power harnesses, power and ground. And those are probably 2-gauge wire, which will make that 90 degree bend. Is it tight? I'm sure it is tight. The biggest question is the fuel line. And I think that because it is stationary, well, it's actually not stationary because the engine is still turning back and forth. So it's not stationary. It's not like a Mercury 600 where a 600 is the power head and everything is stationary and it has a pod drive on the bottom of it. So the lower unit turns back and forth as a pod drive opposed to a regular engine that is conventional in the way that it steers back and forth. That rigging tube's going to move. So with it coming out of that, you know, the rigging tube and then doing that 90 and then coming back around and then being on a rigging tube, does it move enough? I don't, in order to kink the fuel line can make that bend. A fuel line can make a bend, even, you know, 3/8 or 1/2 inch, doesn't matter. 3/8, 1/2 inch will make that bend without kinking. And then I'm sure the power harnesses and the electrical harnesses in there are going to help to keep that from kinking. And most of them are going to have a flushing port as well. So you're going to have a water hose in there that is used for flushing. So that's going to also assist. So those are going to be the two that you got to be worried about kinking. Now, I think you definitely have to really look into the rigging tube and how it goes back and forth once it gets around that bend. You know, it comes out. Most of them are going to come out to the side. They're going to go around by like this and then come down the side and then go back into the front. So is all that's not going to move. The rigging tube's still going to be what moves and that's going to stay with the engine. So there's no movement where the bends are made. And as long as there's no movement where the bends are made, then it doesn't really have a chance to kink. Where you get kinks and stuff like that is where things are moving back and forth inside of a rigging tube that is moving. Now you've got moving parts, whereas the rest of it inside those hard lines, I don't think your lines, your electrical cables or any of that stuff, I don't think that stuff's really moving all that much inside of that system. Now, whether or not, you know, putting it together, I think you could definitely probably mess that up. I think when you pull it in there, if you are trying to, you know, if you cut the line short or something like that, and you're trying to yank on it and like pull it, I think inside the engine cowling and then inside the boat where the lines come in, you need to make sure that you have the right amount of length to those cables. And that's what's going to be probably make it to where you don't have, I don't think you're gonna have a problem. I don't think there's gonna be a problem there. There could there be 100%. I mean, we've seen it a lot of times. I've seen XTOs where the flush port goes onto a little nipple right there on the rigging tube. I've seen the hoses not be on the barbs all the way and be filling the rigging tubes up with water. So there's a potential for a problem with everything, but As long as you have enough, most of the problem with that rigging stuff is when you run out of hose. So if you cut the hose too short, if you cut your negative ground cable too short or your positive cable too short, or you don't have the right length for your main harness and you go to pull on that thing to get as much more as you can, and then you clip it in there and that thing is tight, that's where all the problems come from, because it's under tension and everything in the boat needs to have tension relief. Fuel lines, water lines, electrical connections, like everything has to have tension relief on it. And you know, people that make everything like completely as tight as it could be because it looks pretty, that's all fine and dandy. But at the same time, when you look at the functionality of it, being too tight creates a problem because you have tension there. So on electrical connector, you crimp that electrical connector on the end of a wire. Now, most of them are not soldered. Battery cables, a lot of them get soldered, whereas like everything else doesn't get soldered. So you're crimping that connection on there and then heating it up with the heat shrink to, you know, seal it, but that's just a crimp there. So if you put tension on that and then now you go run the boat through the water and you're just hitting waves, everything's vibrating, everything is flexing, the boat is always going to be flexing, and that tension on that connection can pull that connection out. So everything needs to have tension relief on it. As long as you have tension relief, then I don't think you're going to have any problems. So that's kind of my idea as far as what I think about them. I think it looks good. I love to have all that stuff out of the transom, especially on outboard boats and the way people are using them. Because when you think about it, you get in and out of the boat in the back, and you also pull fish in from the back. And you know, load stuff. Like if you're diving, when you come to get out of the water, you take some of that stuff off in order to put it up in the boat. So you see it all the time, people fighting fish and stuff like that. And they'll go to the back of the transom and they're fighting a fish, and they actually step on, you know, the fuel line or the rigging tube or something like that, and then that thing bends over. So having a way to move that out of the way so there's not a chance of you hitting it, 100%. I mean, that's who's not going to like that idea? It makes the functionality of the boat a lot better. So I do like it. We've got someone says, great videos. Thank you. I've got a 96 two-stroke 40 horsepower Mariner and can't find a video on how to get the engine cover off. Can you help? It all depends. I can't think of how a 40 horsepower Mariner 1996 two-stroke cowling assembly, you know, comes off. But if it's stuck, you've probably got a problem with the latch. So you're going to have to figure out the latch and get that fixed. Usually you can take them apart. It depends on how it is. So a lot of them, like taking the engine, most of the handles, if the handle's on the outside, there's going to be a nut or a bolt on the bottom of it. You should be able to take that off and drop the handle off and then be able to maybe move the top end, whatever is latching on to keep the cowling on. That's what's going to be frozen, whether that's in the handle or this right here. Maybe the handle broke and the latch is stuck and you can move the handle in and out. So you need to get that handle out of the way and be able to get that latch off of the cowling, which is making it stick. Different things for different ways. So like on a Yamaha HPDI or other Yamaha, the 3.3, different models, the handles are set up in different ways. So what you can do on some of those, like there's a housing on the top and behind the latch, you can pry that latch out. And if it's stuck or it breaks or whatever, what we'll have to do is actually take a screwdriver or a punch or something, put it up in there into that housing that holds the cowling. You move the handle out of the way, and then you put something in here, hit it with a hammer, and bust that housing open. Once you bust that housing open, then the handle will flop over and you'll be able to take the cowling off. You'll have to replace those parts. So most likely you're going to have to break something in order to get the cowling off. Just be looking at what you're breaking and don't break something that's going to be a pain to replace. Replacing a cowl handle housing or the handle itself, not that big of a deal. So you just might have to break something in order to get the cowling off, depending on, you know, when you see this or how long it goes. That's just kind of the information. Like some of the new Mercury stuff, the V6, V8, I mean, those kinds of things, those have cable latches in them. And if those things break, some of them you have to drill out the cowling in order to get to the latch to pop it open. So everything's going to be dependent, and some are going to be worse than others. Mr. Wallaland says, nice video and explanation. I have had to do this before. Sucks every time. Can you use heat for those when stuck in aluminum casting? I have had that work better than the weasel. Either use a torch or weld a nut on the broken stud, but these were on steel applications. So talking about a broken bolt or something like that, getting it out, 100% heat works. It's always the option if you have the option. For me, in that case, in that actual situation, I didn't use heat because I didn't want to have to replace the head gasket or the gasket on the crankcase. So the block, putting the block together, there's a gasket there. I didn't want to use heat because if I did, when you use heat like that, depending on what you're working on, you know, if it's close to a gasket and you heat up that block, you can mess up the gasket and have an issue there. So that's why I didn't want to use heat, because I didn't want to have to take the block apart and take the head off and replace that gasket. So I didn't use heat. But if you heat up a bolt, like you said, in different castings, whether it's aluminum or steel or, you know, whatever the application is, some things are going to be different. But when you heat that stuff up, you are relieving a lot of the hold that the corrosion and the buildup and like the bond between two dissimilar metals that happens over time through galvanic corrosion, you're helping to, you know, you're getting rid of that basically. So if you can heat it up, it's going to make your life a lot easier, which definitely, if you can, but at the same time, be thinking about that. If you heat something up, if there's a rubber component somewhere near there, or there's a plastic component or other, you know, things around it, you don't want to melt that stuff and mess something up. So always be careful with heat. Oh, and then also weld a nut on there. I didn't have a welder, or else on that third or the last bolt, I 100% I would have welded a nut on there. That's the best way to do it. If you've got a piece of a bolt with a little bit sticking out and you can take a nut, get it on there, and then just put a tack weld on the end of it and weld that nut onto that the broke off stud where the bolt is, that's the best way to do it. Sometimes it doesn't always work. Problem with doing what I was doing on the water plate, cover plate, was that those bolts were so far in there. I mean, it was like an inch and a quarter, inch and a half in to there. So if you got an inch and a quarter, inch and a half threads, sometimes that, I mean, the distance, the amount of threads that are stuck play a big, big part in whether or not you can get that thing out. If it's, you know, six threads in there, I mean, that's not that big of a problem. But when you start talking about an inch, inch and a quarter, inch and a half of threads being frozen, sometimes you just can't break that stuff free. And then John also wants to know, what grease are you using? And John, I am so glad that you asked this question, because our buddy, actually, I do have something here from our buddy. I got a friend, Chris, actually sent us some stuff, and I wanted to open this up on here to take a look, because I know what is in here, some of the stuff that's in here, but I don't know everything that's in here, because he said it was going to be like a mystery box and that there's some other consumables in here. So I want to open this up and we will take a look. Got an address on there. So yeah, if anybody wants to send me stuff, 100%, I'll open it up and take a look. But Chris, let's see what you got for me here. Says he's got a note here. Says, hey, Aaron, hope you enjoy your mystery box. Thank you, Chris. I plan to. Just my way of saying thanks and giving back. Well, thank you, Chris. Let's see here. My man. We got some Kroll up in here. The large can of Kroll. This is my favorite stuff right here. And then, oh boy, the triple guard grease. So this is the grease that I like. So John, your question is, what grease do I like? I like this right here. Johnson Evinrude triple guard grease. My man, Chris. Oh, I got two tubs. So we got two tubs of some triple guard grease. So this is the good stuff too. This is the blue. This is the really good stuff. More triple guard. This is the stuff that you want, John. I got some heat shrinks in here. This is the good stuff too. This is the half inch heavy wall. That is awesome. What else we got here? We got some silicone spray-o. So that's some really good stuff. And 2-4-C. 2-4-C is good too. So mercury 2-4-C is definitely some good grease. Oh, some engine tuner. So this stuff is phenomenal. Engine tuner, Johnson Evinrude. Looks like there's some more goodies in here, but I'm going to thank you, Chris, for all this. I'm going to go through the rest of this box here, you know, not on this video, but here in a little bit. So thank you, Chris, for sending the mystery box. I love it. And John, if you want some grease, 2-4-C or triple guard grease. That's the best stuff. Problem is, one of the reasons why Chris sent me this stuff is that it is, they no longer make the blue grease. So this is actually brand new. Chris, my man. Let's see here. The new stuff is like a yellow. It's like clear. It's not going to be as good, whereas the old good stuff is this blue color, and this is phenomenal. This is probably the best grease that's ever been made as far as boating is concerned. Now, Tim, we'll do one more question here. Chris, thank you for sending me all that stuff. That's outstanding. I mean, I'm really stoked about the Kroll. Honestly, the Kroll's probably, I mean, I love Triple Guard, but Kroll's got a spot in my heart. Tim says, is it always a better option to use stainless machine screws with nut washer combo if you have backside access, or am I overthinking it? And for boats, just sheet metal screws are fine. When you say sheet metal, I think that you're talking about self-tappers. Stainless steel self-tappers are fine. It's all going to depend on what you're trying to hold. So a machine screw with a nut on the back with a washer or a backing plate, that's the strongest permanent fixture you can use on a boat. Whereas a self-tapper, there's a lot of ease and a lot of strength. So self-tappers in a lot of situations, there's no problem. You're overthinking it. But whenever you are depending on the product that you're trying to fasten down, if it takes a lot of force, if it's a heavy object, if it's in an area that's going to be, you know, taking a lot of flex and a lot of movement, then yeah, you know, doing a through bolt is going to be the better option. So you're just going to have to use some critical thinking about what you're exactly trying to fix and mount on the boat. And based on that, that's going to determine whether you need to do a through bolt with a nut or you need to do a self tapper. Other than that, thank you so much, Chris, for sending me this stuff. Anybody that wants to send anything, you know, we'll hook it up and show you, put it on video, whatever, and put it on the podcast. If you do, I guess, you know, just comment down below or email us, or I might put an address down in the description. Other than that, everybody have a great week, and thank you all for watching the episode.